Public Safety Subcommittee for Tuesday, March 15, 2005, a public hearing on Senate Bill 5530, the Oregon Youth Authority. We are continuing with the agency overview, and we have before us again this afternoon Mr. Bob Jester, Director of Oregon Youth Authority. You'll be bringing forward Debbie Rios, Assistant Director of Program Services, and Lonnie Jackson, Minority Services Manager. A Facility Services presentation with Brian Flora. Is that correct pronunciation?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And capital budgets, a discussion led by or with Karen Olson. Again, good afternoon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, and I'm the Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. I'd like to start today's presentation, if I might, with a couple of minutes to respond to some of the questions that were raised yesterday by committee members that we did not have answers for. And we, starting with Representative Hansen, asked whether OIA had verified the statement made by Mr. Lyman that he had referred a youth to treatment. While there is no specific record of a referral from Mr. Lyman, the youth in question did access mental health treatment, drug and alcohol treatment, inpatient drug and alcohol treatment, and a multitude of residential treatment placements. Senator Devlin asked about the offense history of Mr. Munoz and his placements while in OIA and DOC. He had multiple placements with OIA, and he was convicted of an assault 3, which moved him from OIA's jurisdiction to the Department of Corrections jurisdiction. Beginning in 1996, he was placed in a series of community and close custody placements, including Hillcrest, McLaren, and camp programs. He was adjudicated for multiple offenses during that time, including additional property and additional person-to-person offenses. He was convicted in 2003 of assault in the third degree and sentenced to the Department of Corrections. He served time at Coffee Creek, Two Rivers Correctional Institution, and the Oregon State Penitentiary. Representative Hanna asked that we update the summary of agency actions taken to provide the dates of those actions. The process to revise the foster care rules, policies, and procedures noted in Item 5 were initiated at the beginning of year 2003 and were triggered by three circumstances. One, a budget-driven organizational change that moved the Oregon Youth Authority from a regionally managed model to a centrally managed model, and that was due to the elimination of the area coordinator positions from our budget. An increased emphasis on evidence-based practice in response to Senate Bill 267, a response to concerns raised in the Boyles case, and Item 6 and 7 on that list, professional standards, policies, and the coordinated activities with the Department of Human Services. Those efforts started in February of 2004 and were largely driven by OIA's internal review of the Boyles case. Representative Hanna also asked why OIA refers child abuse reports to the Oregon State Police and not local law enforcement. I would like to correct the answer that I gave Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, yesterday. Under OIA policy, all reports of suspected child abuse from Oregon Youth Authority facilities are, in fact, referred to the Oregon State Police. However, depending on local protocol, a criminal referral is made to either Oregon State Police, a county sheriff, or a local police department if that occurs in the field. So there is a variety of law enforcement avenues, and there are local protocols defining how that occurs in each of the 36 counties. So with that, I would like to ask the members if they could open their budget books to page.
Before we do that, would you please provide the responses that you've just covered in written form, please?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. Is the document that you're reading from, is that on your letterhead? Is that a document that can be circulated?
Madam Chair, these were speaking points for me, but we will get it in document form and get it over to LFO.
All right. We would appreciate that. Any further comments from the members before we go on? Okay, let's do move forward, and we are, just for the record, without a quorum, we do expect Senator Devlin shortly.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you would open your budget books, again with the yellow triangle on them, to page 4. This page illustrates the Oregon Youth Authority services and interventions. And as we have spoken to previously, the majority of the youth who touch the juvenile justice system are, in fact, managed by local county juvenile departments, and they are shown on the far left-hand side of your chart with the 16,238 youth that are in that level of supervision and service delivery. Oregon Youth Authority has essentially three program areas. We have the community services area for those youth that are committed to the Youth Authority for the purposes of probation. And you may recall from yesterday's flow chart of how youth enter the system that some are committed by the courts, the Oregon Youth Authority, for placement and probationary services. And those would be represented in the first part of that continuum with residential and foster care along with in-home placements. Then there are the Oregon Youth Authority facility services, which are in the middle of that continuum, and there are 725 youth correctional facility beds and an additional 125 transitional program beds. On the far right-hand side of that chart, you will see the community program services for those youth who have completed the facility services and are transitioning back to their home communities on parole status. And they also access residential and foster care along with in-home placements. And the total of that system is 2,027 offenders. Population served, the Oregon Youth Authority serves offenders aged 12 to 25 who have all committed offenses prior to their 18th birthday and are adjudicated in juvenile court and committed to OYA, or are convicted in adult court and committed to the Department of Corrections, but due to their age are placed in the physical custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. And the OYA Community Program Services also serve youth 12 to 25, and they are either committed for community placement on probation through juvenile court and or to the facilities and then returned to their communities. Moving on to page 5, the population groups that the Oregon Youth Authority serves, youth committed to the OYA have multiple criminogenic risk factors or factors related to future criminal behavior. Generally, youth committed are chronic offenders having at least three prior referrals. In addition, these youth have multifaceted and often complex needs. The Oregon Youth Authority approaches this from a risk-need basis. And I'd like to show you on the chart, if I may, and I think that this is important because all the youth who come in the Youth Authority are, in fact, with us because of a criminal activity. And these represent the offenses, the highest level offense of which youth who enter the Youth Authority have come to us for, and you will see that over 58% of the criminal activity is a person-to-person offense, and the remainder are either property offenses, which includes arson and drug offenses. But equally important, and we have talked about this in the public safety overview, are the social characteristics of the youth that we serve. And it is important because these social characteristics identify the service needs for reformation and the risk reduction of the offenders that we serve to lessen the likelihood that they will recidivate upon return to their community and or after they are committed to us on probation.
And again, we have the 82% who use alcohol or drugs, the 59% who are diagnosed with a mental health illness. We have 48% of the youth offenders we manage whose parents have been convicted. One parent has been convicted of a crime. 31% are sexual abuse victims themselves. 64% special education eligible. 19% or one in five of the youth offenders we serve are already parents themselves, and 72% are deficient in school credits upon their admission to either the probation and or the facility side. The reason that we emphasize the social characteristics is these are the driving factors around the reformation programs and services that we provide within the system. These are the youth who have committed these offenses. And it's important to remember that no one in the Oregon Youth Authority's custody is there because of these reasons. They are there because of these behaviors. But these are the characteristics of those youth.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jester, how do weapons and drug crimes get into that 5% group? It would seem like any weapons crime, unless you're, I don't know, how does a weapons crime not end up in the person-to-person crime?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, a weapons crime is classified as a property crime, as is robbery classified as a property crime. Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant.
Well, I want to make sure that Representative Hanna has completed his...
Thank you. I appreciate it. Do they have to use the weapon in order for it to be a person-to-person crime?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, a person-to-person crime would be a result of an injury to a victim. And if a weapon was used to injure a victim, then it would be a person-to-person crime. But the threat of injury with a weapon would not be a person-to-person crime, is my understanding of the statute.
Thank you.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a quick one, Mr. Jester. The property crimes, can you tell us what's the lowest threshold for a juvenile, that, you know, like stealing $5, $10? What can you describe, you know, what's the minimum threshold to be considered in the...
Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, the minimum for admission to Oregon Youth Authority services would be a Class A misdemeanor, and that would be a theft of property of over $500, I believe.
Thank you.
$500 would be the threshold for that level of threat.
Manager.
Certainly.
We build in a threshold or inflation so it goes up. So $500 used to be a lot, but there's no... So is that something we look at, that maybe we need to raise that to see if we can reduce our clients? Or,
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, that's a very insightful question, because in a previous legislative session when the Oregon Youth Authority was facing reductions in capacity and we were looking at methodology with which to release offenders and how to manage the influx of offenders coming in the system, we did talk with stakeholders and partners about eliminating misdemeanants from eligibility for commitment to the youth correctional facilities. And in fact, there was concern expressed, which we supported, that that would further erode and limit the access of young women to programs and facilities, and some of the more difficult youth who need services and those services are not available in the community, and or their flight pattern is such they really need to be contained for a long enough period for alcohol or drug or other kinds of programs to have any influence on reducing that flight pattern. It was seen as counterproductive overall to public safety that their behaviors would merely escalate to that of felony law violations. So, yes, it has been discussed, it has been considered, but there has not been a lot of support for raising that minimum threshold.
Just one quick pause. So
certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jester, when did we put the $500, what year did we establish the $500?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisdom, I'm looking at Deputy Lemon, who is probably the expert on sentencing, and we will get you an answer to that question.
So I'm just, Madam Chair, thinking, a watch used to be, $500 was a lot 10 years ago, more than it would be today with the cost of inflation. So it doesn't mean it's not serious and it's your personal effects, but maybe it's something we could look at, and we're trying to consider how we can. It doesn't mean the person doesn't need treatment through other source, but not putting them in the facility would be.
Mm-hmm. Hold that thought.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm actually surprised that only 82% use alcohol or drugs, and it makes me wonder, do you track to this level of the 18% who don't? Is there a specific crime or a group of crimes that they commit that are different than the ones who do use drugs and alcohol? I mean, it just seems, I'm surprised by the number. I thought it would be higher yet.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I will talk a little bit more about that when we talk about specific alcohol and drug programs and kind of breakout of what that 82% represents. But that is double the comparable group in public schools. They're running about 40 to 45% for use of alcohol or drugs. And it is higher in the cohort of young women that we manage. That number jumps up into the low 90 percentile for young women.
Okay.
The data that we're looking at, I'm just reading the period of time covered is 2001 through 2004. And so that would lead me to ask about these first almost 3 months of 2005. And is it too early to say that we're looking at anything trending that would affect the percentages that we're looking at now? And then also, I note that you are excluding conduct disorder. And if we were to consider that percentage, what would that be?
Madam Chair, you are correct that how we are currently retrieving this data, which I will also talk about later, but let me answer your question directly, that every biennium we do a gap analysis, and the gap analysis is a one-day snapshot of all the youth that are being currently served by the youth authority, and we do an in-depth analysis both on JGIS file and look at both what their mental health service needs are for the purposes of designing and developing our programs, but also identifying gaps in those services. And that is where the alcohol and drug data is coming from, is that snapshot that occurs every 2 years. Now, with JGIS, that data is now being directly input into JGIS. And in the future, the gap analysis will become an obsolete methodology, and we will have real-time data that we could give you. For instance, we have been asked a question, how has the increased use of methamphetamines affected the population, the youth authority, affected the commitments? We can reflect back the last gap analysis and answer that question for you, but in the future, we would be able to pull that data today and show you a trend line in real time. So we are actually catching up with the use of our own technology at this point.
The presentation of the profile would also be more meaningful if we had numbers to go along with the percentages. I know you have some information further in your document that draws that out, but it would be helpful to have it presented in that way. Also, what can you tell us about? Let's see, under social characteristics, you have a category for special education, the 64%, and then deficient in school credits, the 72%. How many of the youth coming to you are actually non-readers?
Madam Chair, that would be a figure that I could get for you, but I don't have available today.
could, please. Any further questions?
Madam Chair, I think when you gave us our previous introduction of this, I think if we ask about the sexually abused, probably of that 31% or the number there, is that most of your sex offenses? We talked about that. If there wasn't it, Mr. Jester, if they've been abused, they're more likely to be sex offenders. Is that especially in the juvenile?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, I can tell you that the percentage of sexually abused is higher in young women than it is in boys. That's the average of the two. And I'm not certain if that data is reflected in the section I'm going to talk about with sex offenders. If we don't get to it, we will absolutely have an answer to that question tomorrow. But we can pull that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Also, the 9% past suicide behavior, is that 9% also captured within the 59% diagnosed mental health disorders?
Madam Chair, I believe that would be the case. Of the universe of youth that we are managing, 9% have had past suicidal behaviors or attempts, and I don't believe it is a quantum leap to say that those are youth with mental health issues.
Okay, continuing.
Turning to page 6, you will see a breakout of the population of at-risk youth 10 to 17 in the state of Oregon. It is a bit over 400,000. The good news is that 95.5% of that group do not have any contact with juvenile justice system. That they are out there in their communities and they have not had contact with juvenile justice. 4% of that number are being managed by local juvenile justice systems, and 0.5% or half of a percent are being managed by the Oregon Youth Authority, and they represent the highest risk and most chronic offenders. So when we look at the continuum of the population of at risk, the overwhelming majority have no contact. There is a small percent that are being dealt with and managed locally, and then there is a very small percent who are of the highest risk and the most chronic that the Youth Authority is managing. If you look at the chart at the bottom, you will see the total population managed by the Oregon Youth Authority. 57, almost 58% are currently being served in communities. And of the close custody or the facility population, approximately 15% of those are transfers from DOC, and the remainder, 27%, are committed by the juvenile courts to our facility programs. Moving to page 7, we have offender demographics, and we will be talking more about these individual groups this afternoon. But if you look at the ethnicity, 27% of the offenders that we manage are of minority status, which is about double their representation in Oregon's population. When you look at the gender split, 13% overall of the youth that we manage are young women, and 7% of our facility population is young women. So it decreases when you get in to that further level of service. The bottom left-hand type of crime, approximately one-third of the offenders that we manage are property offenders, approximately two-thirds are person-to-person offenders. And when you look at the age split of the offenders that we manage, 59% are 14 to 17 years of age, and 7% are 21 years of age or older, and 1% at that bottom. So the bell curve comes out as you would hope it would. There's a very small number on the low end of the age. There's a small number on the high end of the age. A majority are in that 14 to 17-year-old category.
What percentage of the sex offenders, current population, were themselves victims of sex abuse?
Madam Chair, we'll get you that answer.
In fact, if you have any data or reporting that helps us understand what we're learning from that population of offender, it would be most useful.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. If you turn to page 8, offenders with significant mental health needs. I already spoke to the process we use to identify this data, which is the gap analysis, a one-day snapshot, to identify the prevalence of diagnosed mental health disorders within OIA's population, both facility and field, and also to identify the gaps in the services. What you see on this page are the findings of the 2004 mental health gap analysis. 62% of offenders in OIA facilities with a diagnosed mental health condition, which excludes conduct disorder, and 57% of juvenile offenders on parole and probation have a diagnosed mental health condition. So
the percentage is different from what you have on your chart. Are we looking?
Madam Chair, the chart represents the overall population. These two split it out by field and facility. If you average these two together, it would be the 59% on that chart. I'm sorry if that's not clear.
Wait a minute. 62% of the offenders in OIA facilities with diagnosed mental health conditions.
Yes, ma'am.
Excluding
right.
conduct. Okay.
And then 57% of juvenile offenders on parole and probation or in our community programs have a similar condition. And so when you average out the 57% that are in community and the 62% that are in facility, you end up with the 59%, which is the overall population.
All right.
And I apologize that that's not clear in this. In OIA facilities, approximately 55% of the youth with a diagnosed mental health condition are also identified as alcohol or drug dependent or abusive. And a similar portion, 52%, that is true in the community. And I think that this is important because this co-occurring disorder where you have a diagnosed mental health condition and you also have a substance abuse, it really takes a two-pronged treatment approach to deal with that. You know, one is the offender needs to be in an environment where there's not access to alcohol and drugs to lessen likelihood of self-medication so that you can deal with the mental health disorders and put some of the youth on appropriate medication regimes, knowing that they are not also involved in self-medication.
Representative Hansen?
When you have a youth with that type of a dual diagnosis, and obviously there's also some criminality involved there besides the... How long of a period of time do you have for them? Do you have them in custody for a treatment program?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that's also a very good question. And you know that in the adult corrections arena for those offenders that we manage that are transferred from DOC, there is determinate sentencing. In the juvenile, those committed to us from juvenile court, there is indeterminate sentencing. And we have the administrative ability to place them back in a community. And that process is done through kind of a three-pronged approach. One is the initial risk need assessment of the youth offender when they come in, which results in the development of an individual case plan. And then there is an ongoing monitoring and evaluation for the progress made toward the completion of that individual case plan and the reduction of risk and the reduction of need that makes it compatible for that offender to return to a community placement, either home or substitute care. It varies with each individual and is driven by what the resources in the community are, the level of the offense, and what that individual plan looks like.
Would you have a range of time? What, 3 months to 18 months? 3 years, what?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, when we talk about the sex offender population, we will mention a statistic that they are likely to spend up to four times the period of facility stay as non-sex offenders. And the data that I believe we will see in that section is around 192 days being the average for non-sex offenders and over 800 days for sex offenders. So that would be one indication of range. For some serious person-to-person offenses, that number would obviously go up.
Please continue.
Sure. 3% of the youth offenders served by OYA are diagnosed with a psychotic disorder, and these offenders are at much greater risk for self-harm, and they pose the most difficult group to manage youth, requiring more intensive psychological and psychiatric interventions. And these are heavy users of the resources that we have in our facilities, both with the psychiatric and psychologist time that we have available, would be that 3% of youth who are diagnosed as psychotic.
And how effective are you in managing that population?
Madam Chair, the Oregon Youth Authority is not a mental health agency, and the facilities that we operate are not, in fact, mental health institutions. And when you have a young person with extreme mental health needs, and I think we can safely say, I'm not a treatment person, but psychotic would rise to that level, there is always a compromise between the appropriate psychiatric and psychological services that are provided to that youth within that correctional setting, because the majority of the youth and the programs are not geared to the provision of mental health and therapeutic environment, but are more based on cognitive work and changing how offenders think. And there are some challenges with managing these populations.
Challenges that I want you to speak in more detail, if you would, about what those challenges are. If there are in your learnings, in what you've learned about managing the population, are there particular issues, concerns that you want this committee to be aware of with regard to resources needed to more effectively manage the population? I just need you to feel free to speak frankly and forthrightly, if you will, about what the challenges are. This is a huge responsibility, and as you say, you are not a mental health agency.
Madam Chair, I very much appreciate the question and the opportunity to address that. I think that we have been very fortunate at the response of the legislative body to address it needs and concerns that have come up in our youth correctional facilities as a result of the propensity of some youth to engage in self-harm behaviors. And we all recall the tragedies that this agency went through with a cluster of suicides that occurred based out of one of our facilities. And a year ago, we had a tragic death at McLaren. We have benefited greatly from additional qualified mental health professionals, which have been allocated to our facilities based on what has been the national average and recommendation by outside experts that the Oregon Youth Authority has brought in to look at our facilities. One of the challenges, quite frankly, that we deal with on a day-to-day basis is that both McLaren and Hillcrest are older architecture, and those of you that toured either or both of those saw that. And they were designed and built up to standards at the time they were constructed, but they are not necessarily the state-of-the-art architecture for keeping kids safe. and there are a number of inherent risks in those older buildings, particularly for youth to either hurt themselves or to isolate themselves from direct staff supervision, which of course then increases the possibility the youth could engage in self-harm behavior without staff detection and intervention. Conversely, the regional facilities, when they were designed, the firm that designed those facilities is also the firm that's, I believe, doing the master planning for the state hospital. And they're actually a firm who started in the mental health and psychiatric hospital design business. So the regional facilities were constructed with the eye to youth safety as well as clear sight lines for staff to have the highest degree of supervision as the youth were in those facilities in any location. So that's one of the challenges that we face. We have always been engaged in some kind of conversion or retrofitting of some of the older buildings. Most recently, we have been in one of the buildings at Hillcrest with the benefit of some federal funding to renovate and make that building safer for housing. And we are engaged in looking at the crisis intervention unit, Madam Chair, which we went through on our way to SITP at McLaren, and that is an older building constructed in the 1950s and needs a fair amount of updating to make it safe for youth. That's probably the greatest lesson that we have learned, that staff can have the very best intention and the very best training and the very best relationship with these youth, and something, you know, goes wrong with the youth, and if the environment is conducive to them isolating themselves or the environment lends itself to providing apparatus for them to hurt themselves with, oftentimes that's the outcome. And so it does require ongoing vigilance from our staff. And I would like to say that as the board of directors for the Youth Authority, I believe that you folks are served by some of the best staff in juvenile corrections of any state in the country. We have a highly committed and a highly motivated workforce, both in our facilities as well as in our field.
Thank you. And I appreciate that reminder that we are the Board of Directors for the Youth Authority, as well as for our schools, and et cetera. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the bottom of page 8, what has the Youth Authority done to meet some of the mental health needs of youth in its custody? First, we contract with community therapists for mental health for those youth who are in the community that are not Medicaid eligible and have no other resource for mental health services. We arrange for mental health services for Medicaid eligible youth, which oftentimes need more than just the eligibility to get those services. You need someone to set up the appointments with the therapist and actually deliver the youth and make certain that they follow through. We provide qualified mental health professionals to serve in all of our facilities. And we provide psychiatric services in all of our correctional facilities. And I will say that I think that Oregon, again, has kind of pushed the envelope in terms of efficiencies and in practice, that some of our outlying facilities, which have smaller populations, but yet they have youth with mental health needs, we have done a combination of psychiatrists meeting with those youth via video conferencing, as well as then in the facility there's a nurse that is providing, you know, kind of physical side of the monitoring of medications. And then that psychiatrist makes a site visit every 3 months for those youth. And all the youth that participate in that particular program, by the way, are given a full workup by that psychiatrist face-to-face in the Valley prior to being placed in one of those facilities where the follow-up would be via video conference. But we're one of the states that have really kind of moved ahead in that arena, as opposed to providing lesser services in rural communities, we have provided very comparable services. And actually, the program that we use originated out of Oregon Health Sciences University School of Psychiatry, and they consulted with us very early on in the telemedicine arena. They do a fair amount of crisis consult that way.
You're calling this a comparable service, but how effective is this approach, psychiatric services by video? What strikes me is that I think we learn and grow through relationships with people, real people. So again, how effective is this approach?
Madam Chair, I think that its effectiveness is driven by the fact that there is a fairly rigorous selection of the youth that would be placed in those facilities and participate in this program. And it would be primarily for youth who are stabilized on medication, have been for some period of time, and it is a medication monitoring that the psychiatrist is participating in with those youth offenders, as opposed to a primary treatment relationship where they would not then be placed in that facility. But I do not want to leave this committee with the sense that there are a lot of psychiatric hours being given to one-on-one therapy in our facilities, because that is not the case. The vast majority of the psychiatrist time that we have under contract or are working for us are spent monitoring medication and doing assessments and workups. The other level of groups are being done either by qualified mental health professionals or contract psychologists, but not psychiatrists.
Please continue.
At the bottom of that page, you will find a breakout of the four most common mental health diagnoses. What you will see, the number one is attention deficit disorder, 25% of the youth, and depressive disorder with 23, oppositional defiant at 13, and post-traumatic stress at 13%. Turning to page 9. The number of offenders committed to the Oregon Youth Authority for sexual offenses has increased steadily over time. As you will see in the chart, top section of the page, starting in 1990, there were 16% of the youth in our facilities that were committed for sex offenses, and in 2005, that number has increased to 36%. The Oregon Youth Authority provides specialized treatment, placement, and supervision services for youth who are committed for sex offenses. Male sex offender treatment, and then the next several bullets list the facility locations where those programs are. Female sex offenders, that population has also risen. They receive services both at Hillcrest and transitional services at Corvallis House. We purchase specialized sex offender treatment for youth offenders in our communities, and we specialize training for OIA parole and probation staff who are assigned supervision of sex offenders on their caseload. There is good news in the otherwise kind of bleak chart showing the increased number of sex offenders. And the good news is that those juvenile sex offenders who have had benefit of OIA programs commit additional sex offenses at an extremely low rate. A March 2004 study of registered sex offenders terminated from OIA commitment between 1986 and 2002 showed that a mere 5.3% were later convicted of an adult felony sex offense, and that is as compared to between 7 and 13% for a comparable cohort nationwide. So Oregon is doing very well in the work that it is doing with sex offenders. And we were pleased to be able to take advantage of an opportunity in partnership with the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association in applying for a 2-year grant from the Department of Justice to develop a statewide system for the management and supervision of juvenile sex offenders and a report and recommendations for systemic improvement across the state will be available in the year 2006. And I am sure that this body will be very interested in the results and findings of that.
We're doing well with regard to treatment in custody, placement, supervision, et cetera. But there has been an increase in sexual offenses committed going back to 1990. Why is that?
Madam Chair, I believe that is a result of several factors. One is that there is an increased awareness around sex offending behavior. There is those behaviors have become less acceptable in this society, and there is a higher level of reporting. And although I don't believe, as we have talked, I don't believe that it is open as it needs to be, it is more open than it has been in the past. And I believe that the environment that we see in 2005 is different than the environment we saw in 1990 with victims willing to come forward and hold their perpetrators accountable. And there is also a significant less tolerance on communities to have sex offenders in communities that have not been adjudicated and have not been through programs. So I think it's a combination of public awareness, there is an accountability factor that's in communities, and I believe that there are people that are willing to step forward. It is a national issue. This is not, as one could imagine, just an Oregon issue, but as across the country, systems are dealing with increased numbers of sex offenders. The other challenge we have, Madam Chair, and why we see the increase at the youth authority level is it's very difficult for private providers to set up sex offender treatment programs in communities because of lack of tolerance and public perception that these young people are not amenable to treatment and pose a very high risk. And because of that, we see an influx into youth authority, more structured and secure programs. On page 10, youth with significant alcohol and drug issues. The majority of youth committed to OYA have significant alcohol and drug issues, as we have talked previously. More than 80% of the offenders in close custody have documented the use of drugs, and 56% of those are diagnosed as substance dependent or substance abusive. And the comparable cohort of youth in the community, that 56% is represented by 51% of those youth. And as you see with the chart in the middle, you know, 18% have no history of alcohol or drug use, 29% have used alcohol or drugs, but the important number is the number that have abused or are dependent, and those are over half the youth, both in our communities and in our facilities. And that poses a significant direction for our program intervention services to reduce that risk factor. Substance abuse and dependence are significant risk factors for continued criminal behavior. I think we know that from what we see going on in our communities now around the methamphetamine epidemic. The following actions have been taken by the Oregon Youth Authority. We are implementing evidence-based alcohol and drug treatment programs in all of our close custody facilities. We purchase drug and alcohol treatment services from community providers for those youth that are in community settings. And we continue to collaborate with the Department of Human Services to ensure that all the services we purchase from community providers are effective at reducing drug and alcohol use by delinquent adolescents and young adults.
How do you do that?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm trying to understand what are the activities around the collaboration with the Department of Human Services to ensure that all the services purchased are effective. What does that activity look like? How do you know that the services being purchased give you what you are looking for?
Madam Chair, the evidence-based practices Senate bill also includes the DHS Office of Alcohol and Drug or Alcohol and Addiction Services, and that office has taken the lead in using research-based program evaluation to conduct evaluation and outcome studies on all providers that are contracted to provide alcohol and drug programs for both juvenile and adult populations. And in the work that we have done as state agencies in collaboration around the implementation of evidence-based programs and services, we, both DOC and Oregon Youth Authority and Commission on Children and Families, has agreed to use the national standards for evidence-based alcohol and drug programs and the evaluation by DHS of those providers to preclude multiple agencies from coming in and doing assessments and evaluation of the same program. So we are looking for certification of those programs by DHS, and once that certification is done, then they are considered for the purpose of a contracting and evidence-based program. JGIS will provide us direct linkage to the outcomes of youth who have completed those programs and whether they have A, recidivated, and or B, have relapsed. Now, having said that, it is important to mention that national studies indicate that alcohol and drug treatment for adolescent youth is effective, can be effective, but there is a higher rate and instance of relapse with young people. And so it is not a, you know, complete the program and the likelihood of relapses is significantly lower. There is a high relapse rate, but ultimately these programs have proven to be successful.
Okay, I want to come back to this piece at a later point, but please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 11, we will see the breakout of female offenders, and we spent some time in the overview of public safety agencies and the judiciary talking about this population. Female offenders represent 13% of the total number of offenders served by OAA and 7% of the agency's close custody population, and they are housed either at Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility or the Corvallis House Young Women's Transition Program. OIA provides contracts for gender-specific services for females in community settings, which includes an inpatient drug and alcohol treatment program and pregnant and programs to serve pregnant and parenting young women. Female offenders do present special challenges for Oregon's juvenile justice system because delinquent behavior is most often accompanied and influenced by a variety of mental health issues, including suicidal behavior, sexual victimization, substance abuse, and problem relationships with family members, which spills over into education. When you look at the profile of the young women, and then you refer back to the chart we have up, there are a couple of stunning differences between these two cohorts of youth. This, again, is the overall population served by the Youth Authority, and what you see before you on page 11 is the female population. There is almost a reverse. The highest percentage of young women that come to our facilities are property offenders, not person-to-person offenders. 45% are property offenders. There is a much higher alcohol and drug use, 93%, which I think answers Representative Hannah's question about believing that number would be higher. It is significantly high with young women, along with mental health disorder, 77%. So three-quarters of the young women have a diagnosed mental health disorder. and the number of sexually abused young women at 56%, I think, is also a stunning difference. 15% have had past suicidal behavior. So this cohort of young people that are entering the youth authority system are entering not necessarily because of the severity of their criminality, but they are youth who have been adjudicated by the court, and they need access to treatment, and often that treatment access is through commitment to the Oregon Youth Authority. What happens because of that, because the criminality and risk level is lower, is that young women have overall a shorter length of stay in our programs, and they are more often targeted for early release when we are overcrowded and or we lose bed capacity. Young women, because they pose less of a risk to the public safety, are often the ones that return to communities early. A variety of services and treatment interventions have been implemented for young women. These focus primarily on increasing strengths and competencies, development of life skills, job skills, family support, coping skills, academic certification, effective communication, healthy relationships, etc. And you will see that those are directly linked to some of the issues that the young women have that come into our system. Pardon me, additional 15% of our residential bed capacity has been developed specifically for young women. As an ongoing response to the unique needs and challenges of young women offenders, we do have a subcommittee of the OYA Advisory Committee that is focusing on a comprehensive review of the services that we have, the gaps in those services, and we'll be making recommendations to the Youth Authority for improvement.
Madam Chair.
Representative Isnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jester, why did we delete the already parents and deficiency in school credits and special ed for the social characteristics? Or am I assuming all 19% of these are women or girls?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, no, I don't think that's a reasonable assumption. I think that we merely point out some of the big differences between those cohorts. We will get you a number on the young women who are already parents.
Yeah, I think that would be important to us.
Absolutely.
And we'll also, if we're going to do that, then how many of those are male members of the OYA, and are they requiring or providing any support, financial support, for their family or for the people that they've impregnated? Does that come under your authority to do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, we have programs where young people have the opportunity to make some money, and that is one of the priorities, both of victim restitution and in supporting children that they have. But we will get the direct number for you on those.
Thank you.
Those two categories.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to understand, so do child support payments come directly to OYA?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, child support payments that come to the Oregon Youth Authority are child support payments that are levied because of the young person in OYA's substitute care system. And Department of Justice does look for child support from their parents or guardians.
Madam Chair, if I follow up.
Certainly.
I want to be more specific so I understand. If a young person within the confines of OYA has a parent or guardian paying child support, does OYA have a preferential claim on that payment?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, if I understand your question correctly, if there is a child support payment being made on behalf of a youth who ends up in substitute care, including our facilities in OYA, we become the payee.
Thank you.
Mr. Jester, do you currently have the amount of residential bed capacity required to meet your population demands?
Madam Chair, the
for
only...
For young women.
I'm sorry?
I'm asking about young women.
Madam Chair, we have the ability to place young women in provider beds. I am not aware that we have a backlog. Many of the providers have converted from what is a traditional residential setting where you have a building and 20 beds, group care, to proctor care where there is the ability to shift gender based on referral. So I have not been made aware, but yet we have not seen the outcome of the study that we have asked the subcommittee of our advisory group to do. And perhaps they will have more definitive information.
And when does that group report their findings and recommendations?
Madam Chair, I believe that that group is either had or going to have their last meeting, and then a report of findings and recommendations will be made. And Pam Patton is a chair of that committee.
So we'll be able to hear a report from that study during the next phase of your presentation before the...
Madam Chair, if we don't have the report, we will certainly get some information from that group and have that presented to you.
Okay. As it impacts performance measures, as it impacts budget priorities, do bring that information forward.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to.
Thank you. Please continue.
At this time, I'd like to both have you turn your books to page 12 and introduce Lonnie Jackson, who is going to present, and he is the manager of our Office of Minority Services at the Youth Authority. So this time, I'm going to defer my seat to Mr. Jackson.
All right. Good afternoon, Mr. Jackson.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Lonnie Jackson. I'm manager of Minority Services for the Oregon Youth Authority. And it's a pleasure to be able to present to you this afternoon and really share with you what OYA is doing in addressing disproportionate minority contact as well as gangs. Disproportionate minority contact exists when at various stages of the juvenile justice system, the proportion of a certain population exceeds its proportion in the general population. National research demonstrates that minority youth have been disproportionately referred to and detained in the juvenile justice system and at most related decision points. Some of these decision points include arrest, detention, diversion, commitment to youth correctional facilities, OYA, etc. Now, disproportionate minority contact of ethnic and minority offenders remains a national concern. Oregon is recognized nationally for addressing disproportionate minority contact and gang intervention. Let me give you a couple of examples to let you better understand the crisis we are in relation to disproportionate minority contact. There is mounting empirical evidence that documents the well-worn path between school and prison. Among it, black men are 8% of public school students nationwide, but constitute 37% of suspensions. More black men receive their GEDs in prison than graduate from high school. OYA has continued to provide leadership statewide in addressing minority overrepresentation, both in its array of services and in its advocacy to address the issue through evidence-based practices, best practices in its facilities and community settings. I'm going to briefly share some of OYA's key efforts in addressing minority overrepresentation. The Governor's Summit on Minority Overrepresentation in the Juvenile Justice System. OYA has co-sponsored this event since the first summit in 1997. I have had the honor of co-chairing the Governor's Summit Planning Committee each year. This has truly been a great example of interagency collaboration, and representation on the Planning Committee has included the Governor's Office, Oregon's Youth, Oregon State Police, OYA, Criminal Justice Commission, Commission on Children and Families, Judicial, DHS, Department of Education, Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, Tribal Representation, Northeast Rescue Plan Action Committee, NERPAC, Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, Department of Corrections, Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. Now, the Governor's Summit has had a threefold mission. Number one, to raise awareness and educate participants about the serious problem of minority overrepresentation in the juvenile justice system. Two, to identify and address root causes that contribute to minority overrepresentation, such as family instability, poverty, policing strategies, racial and ethnic biases that exist, socioeconomic status, education, and again, looking at key decision points in Oregon's juvenile justice system, just to name a few. But thirdly, it's a call to action. Summit participants were asked to make specific commitments to address minority overrepresentation and to implement them. I want to take a moment now and acknowledge and recognize Madam Chair Gordley for all of her leadership, support, and advocacy in helping us to address this serious issue. Madam Chair has moderated each governor's summit, and her passion and commitment in working to ensure that all Oregon's youth have opportunities to be successful with their lives has been an inspiration to all of us. She is one of my role models and a true Oregon treasure. Madam Chair, as always, thank you.
I appreciate those words, but I must say before you go further about Lonnie Jackson, and I know that Bob Jester will want to add to this when he comes back to the microphone. Mr. Jackson speaks with authority about these issues because of his longstanding commitment to young people. He has a passion for all young people, and he speaks with authority because he is an expert. He is a national expert, and we're very fortunate that he still resides in the state of Oregon because there are a lot of folks out there around the country who would love to have a Lonnie Jackson working with them and for them. But thus far, we have been successful in keeping Lonnie Jackson at home. He is the author of, please help me with the title.
Gangbusters.
Gangbusters, which lays out strategies for intervening.
Prevention and intervention.
Preventing gang behavior. He's on a national speaking circuit. I'm sure he's still doing that work. And again, I just want to say to you what it is. I want to honor you and honor your work and honor your contributions to young people in this state. You, at the beginning of your comments, you talked about the disproportionate minority contact that we're experiencing within our juvenile system, which is also reflected in our adult system, and again, it's a reflection of a national concern, a national problem, as you say. But I also think it's we need to be very, very frank about what we're talking about here. We're talking about youth who have been treated more harshly at every decision point in the juvenile justice system or leading to the juvenile justice system, and so that's why we have the disproportionate contact or the disproportionate results as a result of harsher treatment.
Exactly.
So I just want to say that, but again, honor you, Lonnie Jackson. And I don't know if you have any extra copies of your book sitting on a shelf someplace, not gathering dust, but if you would make, if you could make copies available to members of the committee, I think it would be very helpful to their understanding of some of the challenges that we are grappling with in our state. Because you were one who said to us 20 years ago, along with Senator Carter, that the problem of gangs is coming to a neighborhood near you. It's not just a
North-Northeast community phenomenon. This is about something that is happening with young people of every background. And 20 years later, here we are having this conversation. You are continuing to do what you do. And I'll just leave it there and let you get back to your presentation. But you gave me the opening.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And again, back at you as always, and I appreciate your kind comments. Also want to quickly say hello to Representative Hansen, because I remember him back in the MICAP days working together. It's good seeing you again.
That's exactly right.
Yes. To continue, other efforts OIA is making include making cultural competency a priority and value for the agency and integrating it at all levels, which helps ensure access to services for minority youth. A quick example of this is OIA requires contracted community providers to submit cultural competency plans to meet the needs of OIA's diverse youth population. OIA celebrates culture through a variety of events and activities. We have Black History Month assemblies, Cinco de Mayo celebrations, Native American sweat lodges and powwows, Asian Pacific Islander celebrations. Now, these cultural events help build cultural pride and self-esteem with our youth. It's also an opportunity for them to showcase their talents, creativity, and abilities. At our recent Black History Month assembly in February, youth performed songs they wrote, did oral presentations on significant African Americans, read poetry they wrote, did skits on stopping the violence and safe sex. And safe sex and the AIDS epidemic is really increasing in the Black community. And they also performed anti-gang drug rap music, which they wrote. Oregon State University's Educational Opportunities Assistance Program and Black Poets Society also participated in this year's assembly and have been regularly coming to McLaren to mentor, tutor, and discuss educational opportunities with our youth. Madam Chair has been a keynote speaker in the past at this event, and again, it's a chance for our guests, families that attend, and staff to see the outstanding talents and abilities many of our youth possess. OIA values partnerships. We focus on leveraging resources through collaborations. Some of those collaborations include the Communities of Color, which is a multidisciplinary team case management process involving OIA, Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, Self Enhancement Inc., and a wide array of community providers who provide culturally specific services to minority youth. This is really an innovative partnership because it allows the community to have the opportunity to weigh in on youth case management plans in terms of resources, in terms of providers, in terms of better opportunities to work with families in the community. OIA is also a member of the Northeast Rescue Plan Action Committee, as I've chaired. We've engaged the faith community. They've hosted gospel festivals at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility, volunteered their time to support youth in our facilities, for example, with grief counseling, resources and support during holidays, and mentorship of youth in facilities and community. We place a priority on training and maintaining a culturally competent staff. We provide cultural competency, diversity, and gang training to all of our staff through new employee orientation and annual staff update trainings. We also provide cultural competency, diversity, gang training to contracted providers and other community groups. OIA provides translations and interpretation services for youth and families needing these services. Transition services. We provide culturally specific, individualized, intensive monitoring and supervision services for minority youth reentering their community from close custody. These services include mentorship, drug and alcohol treatment, counseling, family support, conflict resolution, employment and education assistance, gang intervention, and crisis response. On page 13 is a chart which shows the ethnicity of the state juvenile population ages 10 to 17. The other chart shows the ethnicity of OIA youth population. Now, a few things to note. Minority youth are overrepresented in close custody. African American youth have the greatest disproportionate confinement. And a recent statewide trend shows Latino youth as our largest growing at-risk youth population. The OIA has an unwavering commitment to cultural competency and diversity, which begins with the outstanding commitment of our director, Bob Jester. I'm going to move on to talk a little bit about gangs and what we're doing to address that issue as well. The United States has seen the youth gang problem grow at an alarming rate during the past two decades. Few large cities are gang-free, and the issue of youth gangs is now affecting small towns and rural areas in Oregon. The Oregon Youth Authority is committed to providing intervention services and meeting the needs of gang youth. We provide a continuum of best practice programs and services to meet the unique needs of minority and gang-affected youth, including gang intervention youth empowerment curriculum is provided to youth in close custody facilities. Now, I don't have the time to share all of our intervention curriculum and strategies. However, it is a comprehensive and powerful curriculum that addresses the following. True realities of gangs, which are really prison, death, and a useless life to yourself, family, and community. Youth who have been involved in gangs are not future-orientated, and they have really not put the big picture together. We paint that true picture for them, and it's not a pretty picture if they continue this destructive lifestyle. Some of you guys know that when they're out there in the streets running in gangs, they're running too fast. They're not thinking about the future, about consequences, about any of that stuff. The advantage that we have, I hate to say it, when they get locked up in our facilities, is a chance to slow down. And by them slowing down, we have an opportunity to incorporate education, information, and really have them take time, maybe for the first time, to really not just look at the consequences that their actions can lead, but begin addressing a lot of other issues and work on begin developing hope that they can be productive young people once they come back into the community. We look at role models, appropriate versus inappropriate. I mean, we have to break it down. A lot of their role models are not what society would deem a value system role model. We really talk about what appropriate role models need to be. Peer pressure is huge, so we work on coping skills to resist negative peer pressure. Value clarification, gangs versus society. Gang members have a totally different value system and mentality than mainstream society, so we have to look at that. It's about self-determination and an individual responsibility. We understand many of the factors that contributed to them joining gangs. However, we do not accept them as reasons to remain in gangs. It's about taking responsibility for your life and having strong self-determination to be successful. Personal growth, not just helping them see the need to get out of gangs. I think our staff do a real good job of helping you see the need to get out of the gang because of a lot of the consequences. But the work is not done there. It's about continuing to focus on the type of social, mental, and educational development they're going to need to become productive citizens. Victim empathy. Impact their lifestyle has had on the victims, family, community, and society. You know, when these guys do a drive-by shooting, they don't hang around to see the damage bullets can do to the human body. Or if someone dies, not comprehending the total reality of taking someone's life. Or the impact grief of the youth's family and everyone who loved him. Believe me, we have them come to terms with this and a whole lot more. There's many more topics and issues I could cover, but I do want to share with you today that our staff work extremely hard with the difficult population of youth to develop positive relationships with them and help youth who have a tremendous sense of hopelessness about their lives begin developing a sense of hope that they can be a productive and positive member in the community. Back when I was running the program at McLaren, we had a saying, be brave to dare to be right, which simply means have the courage to take control of your life and be right. The Youth Authority also facilitates multicultural and ethnic-specific support groups. We've had an innovative gang tattoo removal program, which is a partnership between the Youth Authority and the Oregon Psychiatric Association for youth who are gang-affected or belong to a gang. Some of these youth are now enrolling in school and applying for jobs. The gang tattoos make it difficult for these youth to reach their goals. This project began with one removal laser at Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility in Salem, and so far we have done 944 treatments with the collaboration of volunteer physicians. A laser that is used to remove the tattoos was purchased with funds provided by the Meyer Memorial Trust. The agency is also involved in community outreach activities, which include assisting other groups across the state and employing gang intervention strategies. Now, we talk a lot about the PIES approach, prevention, intervention, education, and suppression. It really needs to be a comprehensive and community mobilization type effort. The Youth Authority has established community partnerships and collaborations at the state and local level to best leverage and coordinate resources. Some quick examples of this is the Going Home Reentry Program, which provides transition services for Department of Corrections gang-affected youth returning to the community from OYA close custody. We participate in community groups focused on gangs and services to minority youth, among them East Multnomah County Gang Planning Committee, Portland Mayor's Gang Roundtable, Latino Gang Task Force, Concilio, Communities of Color for Hispanic Youth, Central Eastern Oregon Juvenile Justice Coalition Partnership. We've helped in providing technical assistance on defining issues and services for minority youth. OYA was a co-sponsor of Central Eastern Oregon Minority Services Conference in Central Eastern Oregon. We've established OYA advisory committees. We have a Hispanic advisory committee to the agency, a Native American advisory committee, and are currently working on reestablishing the African American advisory committee. These advisory committees help to ensure that our services, policies, and procedures are sensitive to and meeting the needs of the diverse youth within our custody. We've also negotiated memorandums of understanding with most of Oregon's federally recognized tribes. Partners for Children and Families Committee, we have representation on that, and members of our staff participate on the cultural competence and gender-specific subcommittees. Now, I know I probably went extremely fast, but I know I had a short amount of time here today, but that's really been a quick overview of some of the efforts and leadership OYA is providing to assist in addressing disproportionate minority contact and gangs. And unless there's any further questions, I can turn it back over to OYA Director Bob Jester.
I have a couple of questions, sure. But I'll go to Representative Lisnott first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. The tattoo removal, that sounds... is that going out in the field, too, or is that staying directly in Portland?
Madam Chair, Representative Winsnett. Oh, I got that wrong. I hope I got it right.
That's close.
I practiced for this, too.
It's a tough one. Thank you.
The program has been at the Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility, and that's where the tattoos take place. Youth from both McLaren and Hillcrest that are gang-affected can participate in the program. I think that there has been a program at Emmanuel Temple that, you know, I've developed the gang tattoo removal program, but I'm not sure if that program is current and still operating.
Thank you.
Mr. Jackson, a couple of questions. The Going Home Reentry Program, the transitional program, is that available to every youth leaving an OYA facility?
Madam Chair, that program is in a partnership with the Department of Adult Corrections, and it's for DOC youth in the OYA's custody, and it's for gang-affected youth. You have to meet the criteria of gang-affected youth going back to Multnomah or Marion counties. Now, Minority Youth Transition Program does provide transitional support services for all of our different ethnic populations in our custody, as well as minority females.
When you said gang-affected youth, it reminded me, I believe there's a bill in the House related to the definition of gang member. Is that striking and cordless?
House Bill 2313.
2313. You've read the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
What are your comments, or what is your reaction to, what does the bill say, and give us your take on it?
Madam Chair, committee members, just after reading the bill, I think what it requires is if you are a gang member that fit certain criteria in terms of indicators of gang membership, and I believe if your crime is turns out to be a gang-related crime, there can be discretion to apply longer lengths of time for you in terms of sentencing. I would say a concern could be right now within our agency, and we're still analyzing this, our minority youth population have longer lengths of stay already than non-youth of color. So that's something that we're still looking at in terms of addressing that particular bill.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to you on that one as well, and we'll also talk to Mr. Jester about it. Your again, I'm drawing on your experience, your expertise, your guidance to this committee about what we should be doing that would be most effective around gang intervention, gang prevention. What should we be doing? More of, less of?
Madam Chair, committee members, I would continue to really support a lot of the issues around disproportionate minority confinement, because when you look at gangs, it's really a comprehensive type of an issue that really inquires. We look at kind of like that pies I talked about before. We have to look at prevention efforts. We have to look at educational, the impact that that's having, particularly with youth and low academic achievement rates for minority youth, expulsion, suspensions. I would say to continue a lot of the advocacy of really looking at those key decision points. And I think that's kind of the momentum that we're going into now, looking at the data to kind of see what that's kind of showing us and really developing strategies based on some of the data that that is producing. We need to do that. We've done it in the past, but I think we need to continue to update ourselves on it. So I always look at it as more of, you can't just pick, you know, like the youth authority or law enforcement or education by itself as a way to say, hey, by ourselves we can address some of the issues of minority overrepresentation, gangs, etc. I think it really has to be collaborative. I think we have to get together and identify again what some of those issues, root causes are, and I think we have to come together with keeping the focus on the most important thing, making a difference in young people's lives, and develop our strategies and interventions and approaches that can really make a difference. We talk a lot about evidence-based programs and best practices, but we need to also make sure, as we're defining what some of the challenges and issues are and things that can work, that we are looking at things that have, through research based, been proven effective in meeting the needs and producing positive outcomes.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We did move pretty quickly. But it was good for us because it's after lunch.
Oh, okay.
Youth of color versus non-color in terms of the sentence time. Did I understand you to say that the youth of color, the average sentence time is longer?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, youth of color tend, and I'm sure others can also talk about it, have longer lengths of stay within our closed custody.
Follow up, please. Is there evidence that it's comparable crime they're receiving additional sentencing versus non-colored youth? I mean, same crime, but the sentence is different?
I think that's, again, Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I think that comes where we, when we look at those decision points where we talked earlier about that youth of color tend to get treated harsher as they could progress, you know, throughout this system. And that's work that we're doing now to continue to analyze that to produce better data. But you look, for example, within our closed custody, our African-American population, 14% of it is DOC, youth. And most of those, some of those will have the Measure 11 youth, which are obviously going to have longer lengths of stay. I think our juvenile population in OYA is about 7%.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jackson, you made a statement, and I didn't get it exactly, something about the African-American men received their GED more than they graduated from high school. Could you repeat that? What you,
Madam Chair, Representative Winsnett.
Good, thank you.
Oh my God.
Two syllables.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I may have got that.
I have it right here. Okay. Black men are 8% of public school students nationwide, but constitute 37% of suspensions.
And that's about the graduation there.
Oh, the graduation. Oh, more black men receive their GEDs in prison than graduate from high schools.
Yeah, let me think about that. More African-American men receive their GED than graduate in prison. And graduate from high school. So, Madam Chair, hold up. So, Mr. Jackson, you're saying then that we're just looking at that segment that's in prison, right? we're not looking at all, I mean, not all Afro-American men. We're just looking at that population that's in the direction of correction, that more, and that's a, that, that statement really affected me, and it didn't sound good about our education system.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, that's research that's been done, and really I can provide a whole lot of other research that can really show you, and when I say crisis, I do mean crisis, about what's happening, particularly with African-American men and people of color in terms of incarceration rates throughout the country.
There is some research, in addition to what I know Mr. Jackson can provide, some research done recently by the Joint Center for Political Studies, and I would ask our LFO staff to do that piece of research for us, or a couple of articles that come to mind. I'll talk to you about it afterwards. Representative Hanna, then Representative Hansen, and then Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jackson, do you see that same trend? And because we have the largest minority population in terms of growth, I think, in Oregon is the Latino population, does that type of trend follow through? Do you know? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, you are correct. Hispanic youth are the fastest growing population, and they are the fastest growing population within our close custody. The disproportion with African Americans, for example, is, again, in our close custody, African American population is 10%. But you look at statewide, I think it's only 1.6 or 2%. So, and I hope I'm answering your question. So we have a great disproportion for African American youth within our custody. However, in terms of just shared numbers, Hispanic youth are the fastest growing population.
Just a brief follow-up, Madam Chair. You missed by a little bit, but I might have misstated. I was more specific to the education piece. Does the education model that you described for, you know, black men that receive a GED in high school, do we have a similar model happening within the Latino population?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I would say that there's equal concern about achievement levels with Hispanic youth. There's a lot of advocacy that has went on from the Hispanic community with school boards in terms of trying to address issues of education, and again, some of those similar issues around expulsion, suspensions, and also they bring other elements to the table as well in terms of language, you know, challenges, you know, so I would say definitely issues with Hispanics as well.
I would ask Ms. Baker to get another document for the committee. The Oregon Progress Board publishes a document. I believe they've done it at least twice now, and there is probably one in the works now if it hasn't already been published. The Oregon Progress Board looks at the progress of Oregon's racial and ethnic populations in a number of benchmark categories, including education, health, employment, housing, contacts with the juvenile justice system, adult criminal justice system, home ownership. There's a number of categories. It's a very comprehensive report, and were it not for the Oregon Progress Board, we would not have this kind of data to inform our public policy making. So it really is a document that we should have in front of us as lawmakers, as we are dealing with a number of policy questions before us, most certainly around education. Because the question that Representative Hanna is raising now around the Hispanic or Latino population brings to mind the experiences that many of those students, many of those young people are currently having in our schools. We're seeing high suspension rates there as well. And those suspension rates have a correlation to, directly related to, what we later see as contact with the juvenile justice system. that's where the path to the juvenile justice system begins. Very well researched, documented. But again, I think, I would recommend that our committee receive that report, the Oregon Progress Report, the most recent report, and that we study it, that we also share it with our other colleagues and just make them aware of how useful the data can be. And let's see, the order, Representative Hansen, did we get you?
Well, I'll just make a real brief comment. In the early 90s, I was on Multnomah County Commission, and I had the opportunity to sit in on a group that met for several weeks developing the release tool for the county youth detention facility. And that's the first time I realized really how subtle some of the forms of discrimination are. If a kid's picked up at 12 o'clock at night on a Saturday night and brought to the juvenile facility, the things that will depend on whether he's released to parents' custody or whether he's held overnight depend on whether there's a telephone, whether mom and dad have got weekends off or are working nights. I mean, there's lots of little things where you think, well, no, this is... Until you really start to analyze them and think about them, you think, well, yeah, we're being fair here. You know, if the parents can come down and pick the kid up, we'll let him go. Well, right there, you've already created a different class of kids and a different set of treatment, or a different, you're treating the kids differently. You know, based on some things that really aren't terribly relevant to either what they did or why they got picked up or what they're down. And then, you know, it just builds and builds. And eventually it gets up to, you know, some much more serious kind of warps when, if you think of a 16, 17-year-old black kid that's 6'4 and 235, probably his lawyer is going to plead him out rather than have him go before a jury, just because he looks bigger and meaner, or there's a fear factor involved with that kid. I hear that kids are getting longer sentences or spending longer time. I'm sure it happens, and it's not necessarily that you can go down and say, okay, all of the kids charged with robbery one all got the same sentence. Who got charged with robbery one, and who was allowed to plead down to a little bit lesser sentence? And by the time those things add up over, a 10-year period working with the same young person, they're pretty well scarred for life. Or they've got a lot more, they're a lot farther behind than they would have been. And even before we get to the juvenile justice set, if they're expelled easier. And again, the seventh grade boy that's as big as I am is more apt to get expelled than a smaller kid that the teachers are less fearful of. And it does have an effect on warping our justice and these numbers. And whether we can ever get completely out of that, you know, I'd hope we can. But it hits us at all, kind of every step of the way. And it was real eye-opening to get to participate in that for a couple weeks.
Well, the great thing about Oregon is that we have been willing to take a look at these issues in serious and meaningful ways, and we've been willing to do it. And it's hard work. It's hard to do this work. It's hard to ask some of the questions. It's harder to deal with some of the answers that we get back and challenges that come with. Looking at ourselves and realizing that we're going to have to do some things differently if we're going to have really have a system that is just. But we have a quality of leadership in Oregon at the Youth Authority, at the in the Judicial Department, at several levels in our public safety judicial system. We have a quality of leadership that has moved us forward and moved us ahead of a lot of other states who are still struggling with how to begin the conversation. We're deep into our conversations that have that really started to take root, I think, around 1993, 94, somewhere in there. And so, you know, we are where we are. And, Mr. Jackson, we appreciate so much the leadership that you're also bringing forward. What would you like, where would you like to go in your presentation?
Again, if there's, Madam Chair, if there's no further questions, I'll probably like to turn it back over to OIA Director Bob Jester.
Thank you again very much.
He certainly made a chair warm, I can say that. Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name is Bob Jester. I'm the Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And thank you for the opportunity to say something nice about Lonnie. When you go to a meeting or you go to a conference, I'm always humbled at the Governor's Overrep Summit because everyone knows Lonnie Jackson. And if you just kind of hang close to him, you get introduced to pretty much everyone in the state because he really is a state figure. And on the national stage, when I have gone to meetings of my peers, which we gather regularly to talk about policy issues and funding issues and other challenges, people say, oh, you work with Lonnie Jackson. You know, he was out in our state and did a presentation. And so it is very nice to know that Oregon has remained on the national stage and is a leader in this area. Just a couple of comments. Representative Hansen, the Casey Foundation work that was done in Multnomah County on the detention reform, in fact, is another, you know, national model, a national example. And as you described, it literally neutralized some of the racial prejudices in decision making, and what was found over a period of a very short time was that the population in detention actually represented the population in the city and was not influenced by disproportionate minority confinement when other strategies were employed in terms of going out and making contact and taking youth home to people that didn't have transportation to come and get them at 12 o'clock at night. And I would be remiss without also recognizing the work that has gone on in Multnomah County and leadership there by both Elise Clausen and now Joanne Fuller and the County Board of Commissioners, present and past, as well as the City Council. I think that there has been a tremendous commitment from the Local Public Safety Coordinating Council and the leadership that's been provided to address disproportionate minority contact in Multnomah County. And I think that as Oregonians, and again as the board of directors for this agency, there is a lot to be proud of for the work that's being done in this area. Representative Hanna, I think the additional answer to your question is that the disproportionate minority confinement of African-American males has been over a long period of time, and there is a fair amount of research that goes back decades on the outcome of that condition. And the statement that there are more African-American males that are getting their GED in prison than are graduating from high schools, I think we will find as time goes forward and we do research on the Hispanic and Latino populations, we will find a similar kind of dynamic may be occurring. But the research on African-American males has gone back decades, and so that is very solid research, and I believe that the Latino population is now, there's more and more research indicating that that trend is very similar for a variety of reasons. Madam Chair, you asked on House Bill 2313, which does define gangs. it also provides for law enforcement and district attorney's office provide testimony in court as to how the gang involvement may have affected the crime, and the greatest impact will be on the Department of Corrections in regards to the potential of sentences for groups that are gang affected being lengthened because of that affiliation. And I would only want to put on record that these are not only persons of color, but there are also white supremacist gangs and other gangs that are primarily populated by Caucasian individuals. And so that's the comment on House Bill 2313. We can do further research into that bill for you.
If you would, thank you.
We would be happy to do that. And
Representative Hannah has a question for you, Mr. Jester.
Well, no, excuse me, Mr. Jester. Madam Chair, it just strikes me, and none of my service here at the legislature revolves around education at this level, but these learnings, and maybe all those folks get this, but these learnings to me are some of the jump out off the page at you directly. And I think we might be remiss if, after you've requested some additional information from Sheila and we have time to chew through that, that those findings from this committee don't go directly to the same committee who is looking at education. Because if this same correlation between incarceration and folks of color and that disproportionate, then there probably needs to be a disproportionate level of activity in education towards that. And, you know, coming from Southern Oregon, I can't tell you that I know that to be the case. That very well could be. But if it's not, we need to take that responsibility and make sure that they know what we're learning.
Well, we're very fortunate to have the chair of the education subcommittee of Ways and Means on this committee. I would just say very briefly that, you know, No Child Left Behind as a policy initiative, a federal policy initiative, came from somewhere. And it came from an understanding that the kids being left behind were the same kids who were going to wind up with a juvenile authority, and then later wind up, you know, down that street at Oregon State. You know, it's all linked. It's all connected. You're absolutely correct, and we do need to deepen our understanding about where the links and connections are. And I would also say that if we don't get it by now that one of the best investments we can make is in Head Start, something's wrong with us. We ought to get that. That's one of our prevention strategies, our intervention strategies, if you will. Senator Devlin.
One of the things I would say, and not to say that there are not significant issues with No Child Left Behind, but one of the things it did very clearly is to give more transparency to things, because before you could simply report what your average test scores were in the 3rd, 5th, 8th, and 10th grade for your entire student population. Now you have to disaggregate those and show what they are for each group within that. You also are held accountable for whether you test in those groups, so you can't avoid testing in those groups just because it might provide information that you wouldn't want to see. And in addition to that, I think what it does is, even going beyond the test scores, you see it, the graduation rates, which are telling within themselves, because the graduation rates are broken down by component groups. So I think one of the things that it clearly does do is makes it far more transparent. So you really can't look the other direction and say, well, this school is doing well for most kids. It's actually doing well for most kids, but there's a lot of kids that it's not doing very well for.
Madam Chair, and I would add to that that our, we know all of us have examples or friends or families that the kids were promoted. They shouldn't have been promoted because the schools were not doing their job. They were not addressing those kids that got left behind, or they were pushing them socially from... I have a nephew that socially was promoted. And that's... So our system, our school system is failing. I would amen that.
Well, without No Child Left Behind, clearly we would have status quo, which is one of the reasons why I'm a supporter of the policy initiative. The funding piece of it is another discussion. But the policy framework within No Child Left Behind is a driver toward that transparency that Senator Devlin is talking about. The other good news is that the other member of the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee is the good representative, Wisnot. So, Representative Hannah, we have some folks here who see these intersections and appreciate them, and we appreciate you for continuing to reflect back for all of us that we need to be stepping back and taking a look at the big picture all the time.
Can I say one thing? This is a very dangerous thing to say. And I don't want anybody to take any offense at this. Part of the question out there might be not have the schools failed, but whether we have failed the children in the schools, and whether you know, we have failed in our commitment. Because when you get to classroom sizes that are 34 and 35 kids, when you overburden teachers with so much administrative work that they don't actually get to teach very much, I think some degree you have to take some part of the responsibility for why you have some problems in the system.
This is where, as chair of the committee, I get to remind us that well, there is another committee, Subcommittee of Ways and Means, where we will, and I know the good chair, good Senator Devlin, will find a way to reflect for that committee the conversation that we're having down here, which is very good. It's very rich and meaningful. And Mr. Jester, where would you like to go?
Madam Chair, if folks would be kind enough to refer to page 15 for affirmative action goals of the Oregon Youth Authority. I think I can finish this next section up pretty quickly. Oregon Youth Authority is committed to the recruitment of a diverse workforce. We prioritize training and maintaining a culturally competent staff. We have developed a set of cultural competency principles, which we have also trained our staff to, and we have posted in conference rooms and meeting rooms and other locations for people to have a visual connection with the values that the Youth Authority is based on. We have recently worked with the Department of Administrative Services to secure an outside contractor to do cultural climate assessments of our agency. And we have, I believe that we are currently in the negotiation phase with the provider that was awarded the contract. And we will be beginning those cultural competent climate assessments in our facilities and then moving out to our field. And we just need an outside perspective on how well we're doing, if there's things that we're missing, or if there's areas that we need to improve upon in the work cultures that we have within the agency. And those are very important to us. When you look at the data in the middle of the page, you will see a comparison between the state's total workforce and also the Oregon Youth Authority's workforce, which is in the middle column, and that is reflected as of June 30th of 2004. And you'll see the total numbers, the reduction from the first column, the second column, was the closure of the regional facilities and reduction of our field staff. Currently, of the 976 employees that we have in the Youth Authority, 34.5% of those are women, and 15.1% of those are persons of color, and 3.5% of those are persons with disability. And when you compare the individual categories of women, persons of color, and people who have declared disability against the statewide workforce average, you will see that we fall behind in the recruitment of women. I'd like to make two comments about that. One is that the bad news is that we're behind. The good news is, however, that we do exceed the statewide average, and we do exceed the parity standards set by DAS in women in upper-level management positions. And in the case of this data, it is program principal executive manager D or above. We exceed the DAS standards there. One of the challenges that Oregon has, and is reflected, I believe, in Department of Corrections, it is reflected nationally, is the recruitment of women in public safety agencies. That has always been a challenge, and we continue to put strategies in place to try to break through some of that barrier, particularly of women working in our close custody facilities. The agency workforce of persons with disability at 3.5% versus 3.9% statewide. This is a self-reported area by staff who want to declare that they have a disability versus those that choose not to. And one of the challenges we have is that more than half of our staff, I believe the number is 550-something, are persons at work the 24/7 shifts in our close custody facilities. And with those positions, there are bona fide occupational requirements that often have to do with mobility and strength, and some persons with disability don't qualify for half of the positions within the youth authority. So that does limit somewhat the recruitment within that classification.
Mr. Jester, your workforce numbers are as of 6/30/04, so we're looking 8 months. 8 months old. Is there a reason why we don't have data that's more current?
Madam Chair, we will certainly get more current data. I couldn't answer the question with why it's not in here.
You could?
I said I couldn't.
Oh, couldn't.
But
okay.
We will get
all right.
You data.
Thank you.
On what it represents now.
Okay.
And then if you would turn to page 16, if there are not additional questions on 15, is the organization chart. And you will see that administration comprises 6% of the FTE, and that's a total of 65 positions, and that includes the director's office, the Office of Minority Services, our internal auditing, our accounting, purchasing, and payroll functions, our budget and contracts, our employee services, our OIA information systems, and the juvenile justice information system comprise 6% of the Oregon Youth Authority's positions. In our facility section, it comprises 77% of the FTE, or 839 positions. And that is primarily due to the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week coverage of the living units for the youth offenders that are housed there. Our community and program services comprise 17% of the agency's FTE, or 182 positions. And these positions both provide a direct service and support to services that are contracted out. And those include residential and foster care, our individualized community services, our parole and probation case management service, our program office, our diversion juvenile crime prevention, and our youth gang services are comprised within that 17%. And Madam Chair, at this time I would have introduced Ms. Rios, Assistant Administrator, to talk about our service delivery, how the services are delivered, and what the values are that we use in that, but I'm wondering if that is better left for starting tomorrow.
That's exactly where we'll start tomorrow, Mr. Jester.
Do we have any closing comments or anything for the good of the order before we adjourn? Again, thank you very much, Mr. Jester, Mr. Jackson. Anything from LFO? Okay. All right.
Thank you, ma'am.